Chapter 17. Protein. In the mid-1990s, as popular sentiment began to turn against the poor, unloved carbohydrate, a backlash originated within the medical community. Carbohydrate-reduced diets are nutritionally unbalanced, they sputtered. That sure sounded good. There are only three macronutrients, after all: protein, fat, and carbohydrate. Severe restriction of any one of these runs the risk of an unbalanced diet. Of course, nutritional authorities had no similar compunction about severely restricting dietary fat, but that's beside the point. Certainly, any such diet is unbalanced. The more important concern is whether such diets are unhealthy. So, for the sake of argument, let's say that carb-reduced diets are unbalanced. Does that imply that the nutrients contained within carbohydrates are essential for human health? Certain nutrients are considered essential in our diet because our bodies cannot synthesize them. Without dietary sources of these nutrients, we suffer ill health. There are essential fatty acids, such as the omega-3 and omega-6 fats, and essential amino acids, such as phenylalanine, valine, and threonine. But there are no essential carbohydrates and no essential sugars. Those are not required for survival. Carbohydrates are just long chains of sugars. There is nothing intrinsically nutritious about them. Low-carbohydrate diets that focus on removing refined grains and sugars should be inherently healthier. Perhaps unbalanced, but not unhealthy. Another criticism leveled at the low-carb diet is that much of the initial weight loss that dieters experience is water, which is true. High-carbohydrate intake increases insulin, and insulin stimulates the kidney to reabsorb water. Lowering insulin, therefore, causes excretion of the excess water. But why is this bad? Who wants swollen ankles? By the late 1990s, as the new low-carbohydrate approach fused with the prevailing low-fat religion, the Atkins diet version 2.0 was born, a low-carb, low-fat, and high-protein approach. Where the original Atkins diet was high in fat, this new bastard diet was high in protein. Most high-protein foods also tend to be high-fat, too. But this new approach called for lots of boneless, skinless chicken breasts and egg white omelets. Once you tired of that, there were protein bars and shakes. A high-protein diet made many worry about potential kidney damage. High-protein diets are not recommended for those with chronic kidney disease, since the ability to deal with the breakdown products of proteins is impaired. However, in people with normal kidney functions, there are no concerns. Several recent studies have concluded that a high-protein diet was not associated with any noticeable harmful effects on kidney function. The concerns about kidney damage were overblown. The biggest problem with high-protein diets was that they didn't really work for weight loss. But why not? The reasoning seems solid. Insulin causes weight gain. Reducing refined carbohydrates lowers blood sugar and insulin. But all foods cause insulin secretion. The Atkins version 2.0 approach assumed that dietary proteins do not raise insulin since they do not raise blood sugars. This notion was incorrect. The insulin response to specific foods can be measured and ranked. The glycemic index measures the rise in blood sugar in response to a standard portion of food. The insulin index, created by Suzanne Holt in 1997, measures the rise in insulin in response to a standard proportion of food, and it turns out to be quite different from the glycemic index. Not surprisingly, refined carbohydrates cause a surge in insulin levels. What was astounding was that the dietary proteins could cause a similar surge. The glycemic index does not consider protein or fats at all because they do not raise glucose, and that approach essentially ignores the fattening effects of two out of the three major macronutrients. Insulin can increase independently of blood sugar. With carbohydrates, there is a very tight correlation between blood glucose and insulin levels. But overall, blood glucose was responsible for only 23% of the variability in the insulin response. The vast majority of the insulin response, 77%, has nothing to do with blood sugars. Insulin, not glucose, drives weight gain, and that changes everything. This point is precisely where glycemic index diets failed. They targeted the glucose response with the assumption that insulin mirrored glucose. But this is not the case. You could lower the glucose response, but you didn't necessarily lower the insulin response. In the end, the insulin response is what matters. What factors, other than glucose, determine the insulin response? Consider the incretin effect and cephalic phase. The incretin effect and the cephalic phase. Blood sugar is often assumed to be the only stimulus for insulin secretion. But we've long known this was false. In 1966, studies showed that oral or intravenous administration of the amino acid leucine causes insulin secretion. This inconvenient fact was promptly forgotten until it was rediscovered decades later. In 1986, Dr. Michael Nauck noticed something very unusual. A subject's blood sugar response is identical whether a dose of glucose is given by mouth or intravenously. But despite the same level of blood sugar, the subject's insulin levels differ greatly. Remarkably, the insulin response to oral glucose was much more powerful. Oral administration almost never has a stronger effect than intravenous. Intravenous infusions have 100% bioavailability, meaning that all of the infusion is delivered directly into the blood. When given by mouth, many medicines are incompletely absorbed or partially deactivated by the liver before reaching the bloodstream. For this reason, intravenous delivery tends to be much more effective. However, in this situation, the opposite was true. Oral glucose was far, far better at stimulating insulin. Furthermore, this mechanism had nothing to do with the blood sugar level. This phenomenon had not previously been described. Intensive research efforts revealed that the stomach itself produces hormones called incretins that increase insulin secretion. Since the intravenous glucose bypasses the stomach, there is no incretin effect. The incretin effect may account for 50% to 70% of the insulin secretion after oral glucose intake. Rather than simply being a mechanism for food absorption and excretion, the gastrointestinal tract, with its nerve cells, receptors, and hormones, functions almost like a second brain. The two human incretin hormones described so far are glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, and glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, GIP. Both hormones are deactivated by the hormone dipeptidyl peptidase 4. The incretins are secreted by the stomach and small intestine in response to food. Both GLP-1 and GIP increase insulin release by the pancreas. Fats, amino acids, and glucose all stimulate incretin release and thus increase insulin levels. Even non-nutritive sweeteners, which have no calories at all, can stimulate the insulin response. Sucralose in humans, for example, raises the insulin level 22% higher. The incretin effect starts within minutes of ingestion of nutrients into the stomach and peaks at roughly 60 minutes. The incretins have other important effects as well. They delay emptying of stomach contents into the small intestine, which slows down glucose absorption. The cephalic phase is another pathway of insulin secretion independent of glucose. The body anticipates food as soon as it goes in your mouth and long before nutrients hit the stomach. For example, swishing a sucrose or saccharin solution around your mouth and spitting it out will increase your insulin level. While the importance of the cephalic phase is unknown, it highlights the significant fact that there are multiple glucose-independent pathways of insulin release. The discovery of these new pathways was electrifying. The incretin effect explains how fatty acids and amino acids also play a role in stimulating insulin. All foods, not just carbohydrates, stimulate insulin. Thus, all foods can cause weight gain. And hence, we get major confusion with calories. High-protein foods can cause weight gain, not due to their caloric content, but rather to their insulin-stimulating effects. If carbohydrates are not the only or even the major stimulus to insulin, then restricting carbohydrates may not always be as beneficial as we believed. Substituting insulin-stimulating proteins for insulin-stimulating carbohydrates produces no net benefit. Dietary fat, though, tends to have the weakest insulin-stimulating effect. Dairy, meat, and the insulin index. Proteins differ greatly in their capacity to stimulate insulin, with dairy products in particular being potent stimuli. Dairy also shows the largest discrepancy between the blood glucose and insulin effect. It scores extremely low on the glycemic index, 15 to 30, but very high on the insulin index, 90 to 98. Milk does contain sugars, predominantly in the form of lactose. However, when tested, pure lactose has minimal effect on either the glycemic or insulin indexes. Milk contains two main types of dairy protein: casein, 80%, and whey, 20%. Cheese contains mostly casein. Whey is the byproduct left over from the curds in cheese making. Bodybuilders frequently use whey protein supplements because it is high in branched-chain amino acids, felt to be important in muscle formation. Dairy protein, particularly whey, is responsible for raising insulin levels even higher than whole wheat bread, due largely to the incretin effect. Whey protein supplementation increased GLP-1 by 298%. The insulin index shows great variability, but nevertheless, there are some general patterns. Increasing carbohydrate consumption leads to increased insulin secretion. This relationship forms the basis of many low-carbohydrate and glycemic index diets, and also explains the well-known propensity of starchy and sugary foods to cause obesity. Fatty foods can also stimulate insulin, but pure fats, such as olive oil, do not stimulate insulin or glucose. However, few foods are eaten as pure fat. It may be that the protein component of fatty foods derives the insulin response. It is also interesting that fat tends to have a flat dose response curve. Higher and higher amounts of fat do not stimulate any greater insulin response. Despite the higher caloric value of fat, it stimulates insulin less than carbohydrates or protein. The surprise here is dietary protein. The insulin response is highly variable. While vegetable proteins raise insulin minimally, whey protein and meat, including seafood, cause significant insulin secretion. But are dairy and meat fattening? That question is complicated. The incretin hormones have multiple effects, only one of which is to stimulate insulin. Incretins also have a major effect on satiety. Satiety. Incretin hormones play an important role in the control of gastric emptying. The stomach normally holds food and mixes it with stomach acid before slowly discharging the contents. GLP-1 causes stomach emptying to significantly slow. Absorption of nutrients also slows, resulting in lower blood glucose and insulin levels. Furthermore, this effect creates a sensation of satiety that we experience as being full. A 2010 study compared the effect of four different proteins, eggs, turkey, tuna, and whey protein, on participants' insulin levels. As expected, whey resulted in the highest insulin levels. 4 hours afterward, the participants were treated to a buffet lunch. The whey group ate substantially less than the other groups. The whey protein suppressed their appetites and increased their satiety. In other words, those subjects were full. See figure 17.1. So the incretin hormones produce two opposing effects. Increased insulin promotes weight gain, but increased satiety suppresses it, which is consistent with personal experience. Animal proteins tend to cause you to feel fuller for longer, with whey having the greatest effect. Compare two calorically equal portions of food, a small steak versus a large sugared soda. Which keeps you full longer? The clear winner is the steak. It creates more satiety. The steak just sits in your stomach. You are feeling the incretin effect of slowing the emptying of stomach contents. The soda, however, does not sit in your stomach for long, and you quickly become hungry again. These two opposing effects, insulin promotes weight gain, but satiety promotes weight loss, cause a maddening debate about meat and dairy. The important question is this: which effect is more powerful? It is possible that the specific incretin stimulated may be important in determining weight gain or loss. For example, selective stimulation of GLP-1, as with a drug such as exenatide, produces weight loss, as the resulting satiety effects outweigh the weight gaining effects. Therefore, we must consider each protein separately, since there is considerable variation in the effect of each on weight. The main dietary proteins studied are dairy and meat, and we have two main considerations here: the incretin effect and the portion of dietary protein. Meat. Traditionally, meat consumption was thought to cause weight gain because meat is high in protein, fat, and calories. However, more recently, many considered it to cause weight loss because it is low in carbohydrate. Which is true? This is a difficult question, since the only data available are association studies, which are open to interpretation and cannot establish causation. The European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition study was a massive European prospective cohort study started in 1992, encompassing 521,448 volunteers from 10 countries. After 5 years of follow-up, findings showed that total meat, red meat, poultry, and processed meats were all significantly associated with weight gain, even after adjustment for total caloric intake. Eating 3 extra servings of meat per day is associated with an extra pound in weight gain over 1 year, even after controlling for calories. In North America, combined data is available from the Nurses' Health Studies 1 and 2 and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. Both processed and unprocessed red meat were associated with weight gain. Each additional daily serving of meat increased body weight by approximately 1 pound, 0.45 kilograms. This effect even exceeded the weight-increasing effect of sweets and desserts. So, on balance, the weight-increasing effect seems predominant here. There are some possible contributing factors. First, most beef is now raised in a feedlot and fed grain. Cows are ruminants that naturally eat grass. This change in their diet may change the character of the meat. Wild animal meat is similar to grass-fed beef, but not to grain-fed beef. Feedlot cattle require large doses of antibiotics. Farm-raised fish also have little in common with wild fish. Farm-raised fish eat pellets that often contain grains and other cheap substitutes for a fish's natural diet. Second, while we understand the benefits of eating whole foods, we do not apply this knowledge to meat. We eat only the muscle meats rather than the entire animal, thereby risking overconsumption of the muscle meats. We generally discard most of the organ meats, cartilage and bones, which is analogous to drinking the juice of a fruit but discarding the pulp. Yet bone broth, liver, kidney, and blood are all parts of the traditional human diets. Traditional staples like steak and kidney pie, blood sausage, and liver have disappeared. Ethnic foods such as tripe, pork bung, congealed pig's blood, oxtail, and beef tongue still survive. The organ meats tend to be the fattiest parts of the animal. By focusing almost exclusively on the muscles of animals for food, we are preferentially eating protein rather than fat. Dairy. The story with dairy is entirely different. Despite the fact that its consumption causes big increases in insulin levels, large observation studies do not link dairy to weight gain. If anything, dairy protects against weight gain, as found in the Swedish mammography cohort. In particular, whole milk, sour milk, cheese, and butter were associated with less weight gain, but not low-fat milk. The 10-year prospective Cardia study found that the highest intake of dairy is associated with the lowest incidence of obesity and type 2 diabetes. Other large population studies confirmed this association. The data from the Nurses' Health Studies and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study shows that overall, average weight gain over any 4-year period was 3.35 pounds, 1.5 kilograms, pretty close to 1 pound per year. Milk and cheese were essentially weight neutral. Yogurt seemed to be particularly slimming, possibly due to the fermentation process. Butter did have a small effect on weight gain. Why is there such a difference between dairy and meat? One difference is portion size. Eating more meat is easy. You could eat a large steak or half a roast chicken or a large bowl of chili. However, increasing dairy protein to the same degree is more difficult. Can you eat a huge slab of cheese for dinner? How about drink several gallons of milk? Eat 2 large tubs of yogurt for lunch? Hardly. It is difficult to significantly increase dairy proteins without resorting to whey protein shakes and other such artificial foods. An extra glass of milk a day doesn't cut it. Therefore, even if dairy proteins are particularly good at stimulating insulin, the small portions do not make a large overall difference. By eating large amounts of skim milk, lean meat, and protein bars, Atkins enthusiasts were unintentionally stimulating their insulin to the same degree as before. Substituting large amounts of lean, often processed meat for carbohydrates was not a winning strategy. Reducing sugar and white bread was good advice, but replacing them with luncheon meats was not. Furthermore, with increased meal frequency, the protection of the incretin effect was diminished. The hormonal obesity theory. Now we can modify the hormonal obesity theory to include the incretin effect to provide the complete picture, as illustrated in Figure 17.2. Animal protein is highly variable but comes with the protective effect of satiety. And we shouldn't ignore the protective power of the incretin effect. The slowing of gastric motility increases satiety so that we feel more full and therefore eat less at the next meal, or even skip a meal altogether to allow ourselves time to digest. This behavior is instinctive. When children are not hungry, they will not eat. Wild animals also show the same restraint. But we've trained ourselves to ignore our own feelings of satiety so that we will eat when the time comes, whether we are hungry or not. Here's a small tip for weight loss, one that should be obvious but is not. If you are not hungry, don't eat. Your body is telling you that you should not be eating. After indulging in a large meal, such as we do at Thanksgiving, we feel paranoid about skipping the next meal because of an irrational fear that missing even a single meal will wreck our metabolism. So we circumvent the protective effect of incretins by rigidly scheduling 3 meals a day with snacks, come hell or high water. There is still more to learn. Blood glucose accounts for only 23% of the insulin response. Dietary fats and proteins only accounts for another 10%. Close to 67% of the insulin response is still unknown, which is tantalizingly close to the 70% contribution to obesity that is inherited, as described in Chapter 2. Other suspected factors include presence of dietary fiber, an elevated amylose-amylopectin ratio, preserved botanical integrity, whole foods, presence of organic acids, fermentation, addition of vinegar, acetic acid, and addition of chili peppers, capsaicin. Simplistic arguments that carbs make you fat, or calories make you fat, or red meat makes you fat, or sugar makes you fat do not fully capture the complexity of human obesity. The hormonal obesity theory provides a framework for understanding the interaction of disease. All foods stimulate insulin. Thus, all foods could be fattening, and that's where the calorie confusion emerges. Since all foods could be fattening, we imagined that all foods could be measured in a common unit, the calorie. But the calorie was the wrong unit. Calories do not cause obesity. Instead, insulin is responsible. Without a framework for understanding insulin, it was impossible to understand the inconsistencies of the epidemiologic evidence. The low-fat, caloric reduction approach was a proven failure. The high-protein approach was subsequently proved a failure. And so many returned to the failed caloric reduction approach. But a new approach known as the paleo diet, sometimes referred to as the caveman diet or the original human diet, was gaining strength. Only foods that were available in Paleolithic or ancient times are to be consumed. Dieters avoid all processed foods, added sugars, dairy, grains, vegetable oils, sweeteners, and alcohols. However, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, spices, herbs, meats, seafood, and eggs are all acceptable. The paleo diet does not limit carbohydrates, proteins, or fat. Instead, the consumption of processed foods is curtailed. Remember that the single defining characteristic of the Western diet is food processing, not macronutrient content. The toxicity lies not in the food, but in the processing. The low-carb, high-fat, or low-carb, healthy-fat, LCHF diet, is similar, maintaining a focus on real foods. The main difference is that the LCHF diet allows dairy products and is stricter on the fruits due to their carbohydrate content. The LCHF approach makes some sense, as dairy foods are generally not associated with weight gain. This factor allows for greater dietary choice and, hopefully, better long-term compliance. The paleo LCHF diet is based on the simple observation that humans can eat a wide variety of foods without becoming obese or developing diabetes. These foods can be eaten without counting calories, counting carbohydrates, or using food diaries, pedometers, or any other such artificial means. You simply eat when hungry and don't eat when full. However, the foods are all of an unprocessed nature and had been consumed by humans for thousands of years without causing illness. They had withstood the test of time. These are the foods that we should base our diets on. There are no intrinsically bad foods, only processed ones. The further you stray from real food, the more danger you are in. Should you eat protein bars? No. Should you eat meal replacements? No. Should you drink meal replacement shakes? Absolutely not. Should you eat processed meats, processed fats, or processed carbohydrates? No, no, and no. While we ideally would all eat grass-fed beef and organically raised strawberries, let's be real here. There will be times when we'll eat processed food because it is cheap, available, and, let's face it, delicious. Think ice cream. However, we have, over the centuries, developed other dietary strategies such as fasting to detoxify or cleanse ourselves. These strategies have been lost in the mists of time. We will rediscover these ancient secrets soon, but for now, stick to the real food. Natural foods contain significant amounts of saturated fats. This fact naturally leads to the questions: won't all these saturated fats clog up my arteries? Won't it lead to heart attacks? The short answer is no. But why not? That's the subject of the next chapter.